night like last night is a fabulous time for players like that to really shine. And
I think the television was on in most Irish homes last night because it was a big news story. Coleman, it was on in your house as well.
It was. I actually recorded it and had to watch it later, but it was an absolute torture not to find out the results. I couldn't go on social media, couldn't turn on my phone, so I was a little bit delayed on it, but watched it in full and really enjoyed it.
And what did James McLean do? He scored the goal, but what did he do at the end of the match that made him the sweetheart and the darling of every mother and wife watching?
Oh, stop, your heart would break. He ran over to the side and he looked, you saw his eyes looking for someone in the crowd, and finally his eyes met his wife's eyes and she ran down to the side and he gave her a big hug and a kiss and everyone went ah all over Ireland.
So he's made, that's it for life now. He's there. It's funny, you should say, with the tabloids, it does actually replace any most serious news stories on the front of the tabloid newspapers as well, because that's what people want. That's what people will pick up the paper for.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in Ireland, I think in most countries, the national soccer team has a special place. I think in Ireland, because we have a history, we have had a few magic moments from 1988, 1990, 1994, which spawned songs and novels and art and all sorts of things, and people of my age look back and wonder, will those days ever come back again? You know, so I think the Irish football team, probably because we're not among the best in the world generally, has given some really magic moments to the country over the years, and so everybody lives in hope that one day another one of them is going to come.
So what else was in the papers today?
The budget. It's full of the budget. What's going to be in it? An awful lot of it being leaked. There's an awful lot of political theatre goes on about the budget. I mean, the stories about all late night meetings last night between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil to hammer out points. Late night meetings with the Independent Alliance to hammer out points. Everybody wants to make it clear in the media that if it wasn't for us, we wouldn't have got that reduction in the pupil-teacher ratio, or we wouldn't have got that extra 100 million for the health services or whatever. So there's a lot of posturing, I think, by different ministers and different political parties looking to get credit this morning for things that are going to be announced in the budget.
Such as?
Increases in commercial property tax transactions apparently are the way they're going to fund an awful lot of the increases in spending. In all the talk about what's going to be decided in the budget, people forget that every year the national budget this year is 58 billion euro. And there were 300 million euro to play with, effectively. In other words, the vast bulk of the money spent by government every year is accounted for by spending on roads, on hospitals and education, on teacher salaries, on public sector salaries, on a whole range of things the state spends money on every year. So the amount they had to play with is relatively small. But there is a huge amount of political discussion about what's going to be done. Now, the 300 million they had to spend, whether it was on giving tax cuts or on spending more on public projects, has been increased, depending on which newspaper you read, to either 900 million or 1 billion euro by proposals to increase tax. There'll be increases in commercial property tax, an extra 50 cent on the packet of fags. And between those things, they will have about a billion euro to spend. Some of it will go on cuts in the universal social charge. There's going to be a very modest rise, they're telling us, in the threshold for the higher rate of tax. I suppose of interest to some of your listeners, there is talk about a significant boost towards spending on mental health services as well.
Yeah, Coleman, you might have an opinion on that.
Yeah, I mean, again, allocation and spending are two different things. I mean, I think we had that issue a number of years, year or two ago, where there was this 32 million that was allocated, but the issue was that it couldn't be spent or they couldn't get the resources. And any idea in the budget how they're, whether it's just allocated or is it designated to spend, or did they make that decision yet?
I think it's money. You're absolutely right. I think it's money which is allocated for specific purposes. It is designated to be spent on particular things, but there is still an ongoing struggle to actually get it spent. I was speaking yesterday to somebody working in a section of the health services, who was saying to me that she expected a significant additional amount of money to be allocated to her area, but she said, "I will spend the entire year campaigning to actually get the money and get it spent." So you hear of money being ring fenced for whether it's mental health services or whatever, but it sits behind that ring fence until somebody, you know, actually gets it out and extracts it.
And just while we're on the subject of mental health, there is money allocated to Dundrum, to the new project there, 100 million I think there's somewhere allocated there as well. So that money may or may not be included there. We don't know what it is. Can I ask you a question just in general terms about these kite flying exercises, the speculation? And speculation's been going on for a month. I think, was it Leo Varadkar issued a statement saying we don't want anybody flying kites over the next few weeks, which every Taoiseach issues, or every whip issues over the few weeks. But we're looking at the front page of the Independent today, front page of the Irish Times. You've listed some of the speculation that's there. How true will that be? How will that by today, should we be saying that's actually going to be in the speech later today?
Yeah, I think normally the way the budget runs in recent years, there are very few secrets revealed when the minister actually stands up on budget day. Most of it's been put out there. He will usually have one or two things kept in reserve. There'll be one or two surprises. And an awful lot of it is media management. I mean, there's so much announced in the budget that if it's all announced on one day, the general public only pick up small pieces of it. So different ministers in different areas will get their bit out early and hope to get it on the front of the paper 2 days before the budget. Because if it's held back for the budget, it'll be drowned in the sea of all the other stuff and it won't be heard about. So yes, there's an awful lot of kite flying and an awful lot of news management by the government, spreading out all their good news over a period of days so as everybody hears all the different aspects of what's going to be in the budget.
God, those PR people are hard at work. Sorry,
they're a dreadful bunch.
Mark, in an era of new politics, what will be the difference? What will new politics bring to the budget that we haven't seen before?
It's a good question. There have been more discussions with Fianna Fáil, obviously, about the budget this time around than there would normally be if there were a majority government, for the simple reason that the government needs the acquiescence of Fianna Fáil to ensure the budget is passed. I see Fianna Fáil in the newspapers today saying that it has secured a reduction in the pupil-teacher ratio. Now, I don't know whether Fianna Fáil secured that or not, or whether Richard Bruton, as Minister for Education, would have wanted to do that anyway. So you will see, you know, the opposition parties who are supporting the government, or indeed the independent alliance who are part of the government, wanted to make it really clear that they had a role, that what they're doing is worthwhile. You see, the independent alliance, actually, we were talking about the mental health funding. The independent alliance and Finian McGrath in particular is talking about additional funding in the area of disabilities and mental health, and trying to make it clear that were it not for him, that wouldn't be happening. Again, we can never know if that's true or not. Government will allow people like that to claim credit in order to keep them on board for specific issues. There's a lot of political game playing and posturing goes on.
So again, it's like the idea of who wins out, economics or politics, isn't it, about votes and parish pump stuff. Is that gone from politics, or is that naive to say, suggest that might be there? Is it still very evident in the leaks and the way in which...
Oh, I mean, parish pump politics is still there. You need look no further than Step Aside Garda Station, which I'm sure Shane Ross will tell us. You know, the level of crime in Step Aside was so shocking that this was the Garda station of all the Garda stations in all the counties and all the country that needed to be opened. I don't think most people believe that. So parish pump politics is alive and well. But after all the talk about the budget, this is a mainstream, politically centrist budget, with most of the 58 billion the government will spend every year going to the things that it went on last year. The government making it clear that it's balancing the books for the first time this year to try and give a signal out there that the bad times are over, and some pretty modest tax cuts that, you know, in 1 year that people will notice pretty marginally in their pay packets, but that's it. So there isn't radical change. There weren't really radical choices that the government was considering. It was always going to be like this.
Yeah, I think €750 increasing the threshold at the higher rate. So you divide that by two, which 52% being the marginal rate, and off of saw the higher rate and the effective rate.
It's possibly about €30 per month per person.
Approximately. Which is not to be sniffed at.
And if it happened next year and the year after, it all adds up. But it's not a radical change in 1 year.
So, look, that's the budget. I think you've fairly laid that out as well. All politics are local. And you won't be part of the budget if you're not elected next year. So if you don't get your spoke in and be between the local people, whether that be in Kerry, just for instance, or a Step Aside, for instance.
Yes. If you're not part of the problem, you know...
So let's move on a little bit from the budget. Anything else that caught your eye there?
Okay, I see. Funny case a lot of us have followed over the past few years. Ibrahim Halawa, who after seemed an interminable number of years, was finally acquitted 2 weeks ago, is still in jail.
And so this is the young Irish citizen who travelled to Egypt to be part of the protests against the government, was arrested. And how long has he been in jail now?
I believe it's over 3 years.
Yeah.
But he was acquitted 2 weeks ago after a really long trial process. And I read in The Independent today that the Egyptian authorities haven't even started processing the paperwork for his release. So again, the Egyptian justice system is quite different from ours, but it does seem like a really pretty unsatisfactory way to treat somebody who their courts have now declared innocent. And you would wonder what state he is in. He's a young man, is 17 or 18, I think, when he first went to jail. He's now 20, 21. You know, it's a shocking way to spend those few years of your life.
Yeah, interesting. I read an interview with an Egyptian civil rights activist who said he's not alone in this, that there are others who are in exactly the same boat. Is he being singled out for treatment, for worse treatment than anybody else. It doesn't seem so. It seems like everybody who's been arrested and has been acquitted is in the same boat as well. Something else there?
Yeah, I see the president is in Australia, and in his mid-70s, seems to have extraordinary energy. He made a speech to the regional parliament in Perth yesterday. He met Aboriginal leaders. He met the governor of Western Australia. He took part in something called a Wagyu smoking ceremony. It's not clear what that is. It does sound interesting.
Do you not remember that from your college days?
And he unveiled a famine memorial, and then he was asked questions about was he going to run again. I don't know if you followed, there's all this discussion whether he will run again, and he seemed to say a month ago that he would decide at the ploughing championships next year, which is obviously a month before the election would take place, and a curious place to make that kind of decision. But he made it clear in Australia to reporters that no, he would have decided before the ploughing championship, some time before. So still, he seems to be he's leaving it open, the idea that he will run again. It really isn't clear what he will do. He seems to be retaining extraordinary energy.
What's your feeling on it? If his health holds up.
If his health holds up and his health seems fine, I would say he will be tempted to go again. If he's enjoying himself, which he is, opinion polls are saying that he's very popular with the general public. The problem is, if he doesn't say he's going again, a lot sooner than the ploughing championships, it's possible that other candidates will line up and he will face a contest. Now,
we've only heard one come out of the
There are people saying one senator they're going to run anyway, so he may well face a contest, and that would be interesting. A presidential election campaign is grueling for anybody at any stage. So
it's also grueling for the public finances.
Yeah, in the grand scheme of things, it's not a huge sum of money. And if he doesn't run again, there may well be a contest anyway. So it's impossible to know. He's playing his cards close to his chest, but he looks like he's enjoying himself and his Wagyu smoking ceremony.
he didn't inhale. Go ahead.
Interesting, because obviously the radio station has related to mental health. There's an item in The Independent that there's a team from TCD and the Royal College of Surgeons who made a finding seen as interesting in the study of schizophrenia, that there are scientists led by the Smurfit Institute of Genetics who have found flaws in blood vessels in the brains of some people may contribute to the mental illness, and perhaps there are medications that could be developed to deal with this. Now, I'm always cautious of newspaper stories talking about breakthroughs in the area of medicine, but nevertheless, this looks like something interesting, and I suppose with every illness and disease, there's rarely one huge breakthrough that solves everything. It's always piece by piece, new piece of research and new piece of research slowly moves towards better treatment and better outcomes.
And I think from the point of view of any research, before it gets to the shelves or becomes a reality, there's such a distance between that. But I would be equally kind of dubious about these things and cautious about them, but absolutely excited, because revelations in mental health care, especially in conditions like schizophrenia, are so few and far between. We can go decades before having breakthroughs in regards to the treatment of those conditions, and any of the breakthrough treatments have been so important to the way in which people have experienced mental health treatment. It's appropriate to get excited about something like this. So fair play to the teams in TCD and RTÉ for putting that out there.
Mark.
Okay, I see. Interesting contrast between the Irish Times and the Examiner on the issue of the border disputes and ethnicity. The Irish Times has on its front page Spain warning Catalonia against a declaration of independence. We've all followed the issue about Catalan independence.
That was on the front of the newspapers, obviously because of the protest, but obviously there was protest this weekend, the opposite type of protest. This was a unity protest that were there. The pictures were all on the front pages of the newspapers. Was it yesterday or today?
It was, that's right. I mean, there are a variety of different views in Catalonia about independence, and you might have thought from all the coverage last week that all the Catalans wanted independence and all the Spanish didn't want that. It's not as simple as that. There is a significant proportion of the population within Catalonia who doesn't want independence or would like a certain element of devolution and autonomy short of independence, and I think that became clear in the protests in the last few days. But the Irish Times has that on its front page. The Examiner, however, has a different border dispute, which is Cork County Council demanding an arbiter with the Cork City Council in a dispute over the possible extension of the Cork City boundary.
This has been ongoing. This has been going on for a while now.
This has been ongoing for a while, so you know, there's a the mayor of Cork says that it would be an intolerable imposition on the rights of an independent local authority to extend the Cork city boundary into Cork County. There's talk about whether the city boundary would cover Cork Airport, Ballincollig, Blarney, Glanmire, Little Island, and Carrigtwohill. So I just thought it was interesting the contrast between this dispute in Cork and the Catalan Spanish dispute.
This is a turf war. This is like the Jets and the Sharks in West Side Story. But essentially, it's because Cork City has expanded so much since the original boundaries were drawn for the county council areas. The council now feels that they are entitled to extend it to those areas, which are high rate paying areas, incidentally, because higher density of housing means there's more taxes to be paid and more rates and more revenue to be gotten from that. And Cork County Council don't want to lose that.
Yeah, and I suppose the reality is that our urban areas are grown. I mean, Dublin, the city of Dublin, stopped short of the county of Dublin when I was growing up. Now it spreads into Wicklow and Kildare and Meath and all the neighbouring counties. You know, that the nature of the urban areas is changing. So there is an argument to say Cork City has expanded, but I can see why Cork County Council would feel that they didn't believe that large, as you say, rate-paying chunks of their county should move into the Cork City area.
One more thing that caught your eye, Mark?
One more thing that caught my eye, as soon as there's music playing here, is that five things you didn't know music could do for your health.
This is a revelation.
This is a revelation.
People have stopped walking outside the bubble here in the reception area in St. Patrick's Mental Health Services, and we're all waiting with bated breath. Where was this? Where did this appear?
This is in the Herald, which in my young day was called the Evening Herald, but now comes out in the morning, along with all the other newspapers. Music will help you exercise, as we know. It makes you smarter, which is interesting. Something called the Mozart effect, which shows that participants who listen to Mozart, as opposed to silence, score higher marks in spatial reasoning tests.
So that's one of the... Give me the five things.
Okay, the third thing, it jogs your memories, which we know it does. Music has a nostalgia effect. Makes you happier, generally. Causes your brain to release dopamine, and this therefore makes you happier. And helps you manage pain, that after surgery, patients need less pain medication than those who have not listened to music.
I love James Taylor, but just give me morphine. Yeah, more and more morphine, that's all I need. And have you found that, Coleman?
It's amazing. All the young people that I would work with will all refer to music as having this. And oftentimes it's not how you'd imagine it. It's not that they'd listen to terribly uplifting music. They might listen to kind of quite dark lyrics and sadness. But there's something about the music that makes them feel less alone. So if you're connecting with, you know, if you're going through a breakup and you're listening to someone who's experiencing heartache in a similar way to you, there's something... a companionship through that, or, you know, I don't know whether Mark Almond or something would get you through a particular tough time. But it's amazing how many young people will turn to music, and when they're distressed and maybe in the evening time in the unit, that's where they go. They get their
earphones. Just explain what you mean by the unit.
Sorry, in the inpatient unit here in St. Patrick's Mental Health Services, I work on the adolescent unit, which is the 12 to 18 year olds. And without music and their iPods, you know, they would really be at a loss, because it's their sanctuary. There's something really comforting about it. The flip side of that is, I'm not so sure the listening to Mozart when you've expecting a baby is going to mean you're going to have a genius, and I think we can take that side of it a little bit too far. But from the point of view, there is something... I mean, I wouldn't be a music lover. I would certainly not be an anorak around music. I enjoy it, but I wouldn't have that relationship with it. But for certain young people who are experiencing distress, it is an absolutely essential toolkit for them to cope with that level of upset and distress.
Yeah, but if, as you say, for a young person experiencing pain or distress, if a pop singer has managed to capture that and express that in a song, it really means an awful lot to hear somebody saying, yeah, and you listen to a particular song, everyone thinks the R.E.M. song, Everybody Hurts, became an anthem for mental health, because it just said, if you feel like this, you're not alone. Mm. And those kind of songs, I think, are hugely important to young people and mean a lot to them.
Yeah. Sure. And to old people.
And
like
me actually.
Yeah.
Yes, all by myself, don't want
to
be...
It's important to listen to the actual track.
Speaking of music, let's take a little piece of music here, and then we're going to come back and you can criticise. Coleman and myself took a couple of pieces from the newspaper, and you get to comment on those.
Super.
You're listening to Walk in My Shoes, FM.
I was on a heavy tip, trying to cross a canyon with a broken limb. You were on the other side, like always, wondering what to do with life. So I reasoned I was drunk enough to deal with it. You were on the other side.
kind of man. This is Walk in My Shoes Radio, walkinmyshoes.ie. If you want more details of that, that's our researchers talking in the background. That's okay, you failed your exams. It's fine, it's over, it's over. Myself and Coleman Nocter presenting the programme today. We're joined by Mark Brenlock, who's the public affairs person in Murray Consulting, also former chief political correspondent at the Irish Times. Father of three, husband, and singer of ballads at night time after 14 glasses of wine.
That sort of thing.
Just wait, we'll get a mic for you there. You're denying singing at night time?
I do. I just don't remember it very well.
Myself and Coleman had a quick look through the papers, and we have a couple of stories as well. Coleman?
Yeah, the story that jumped out at me was in the Telegraph, and it was about girls' schools scrapped the entrance exam, and it was about the schools were looking into the pressure that young people were under about preparing for entrance exams, and these kind of astronomical fees that parents were paying support tutors to prepare these children to get into the prestigious schools, that whatever they wanted. So there's an initiative to kind of get rid of those. And I just think that is, like, where are we when we're looking at an entrance exam, which is something to assess your level of ability, and we're getting into grinds. And so many times you speak to parents about, you know, reducing pressure on young people. And sometimes that falls on deaf ears from the point of view of that it's sometimes a parental expectation that we want the best for you and how much is enough. And I just thought it was an interesting story given that our anxiety levels are up. And I think we have an emergence of a kind of a tiger parent issue. I have a friend who's involved in a Montessori school, and she will just say, you know, parents are coming up a lot of the time saying, why can't he count to 10? You know, he's 2.5. That kid there can count to 10. And if we're starting at that level, where there's that level of pressure, we're really creating a lens for young people. It's just about anxiety. It's about pressure. So fair play to the school in
what school England. Is it?
It's a school in London, the North London Girls' School Consortium. So there's a number of schools together coming on to scrap the entrance exam.
But does that mean that at the start of the academic year, maybe for 3 or 4 months, you have an assessment period for those young, for those children, I call them children, 12-year-olds, 11-year-olds coming in, because you can't give them certain... In my day, back in 1985 when I went in, we were streamed A1 to 5 in St. David's in Artane. There was an entrance exam. A1 did French. They did business studies and technical drawing. I think they were the three. And A5, all the way down, they spent a lot of time sweeping up and doing various things. But they did art, they did metalwork, they did woodwork. So they were marked when they went in that this was what they were going to do. And very few, when I went to my leaving cert year, very few people from that year were doing honours level subjects at that stage. So they were marked at 12.
I think that's changed an awful lot. Again, when I was in school, it's the same. We had A1, A2, A3, and the A1 class got the best teachers, and it went down from there, which is an appalling way to run a school. Now, I think most Irish schools, to my own limited experience anyway, is that they try to have mixed ability classes in first year. They try and ensure that they're not streamed, that each of the two or three or four different parts of first year has children of mixed ability. And then later on, you decide, are you able for honours maths or pass maths or honours English or pass English? And depending on what your ability is in those particular subjects, you do those subjects. But there isn't, as you say, the same marking of people. You are permanently in the A stream, you are permanently in the A5 stream.
I think there is a degree of truth to that in terms of the mixed ability, but there certainly is still streaming. And, you know, there's children who are told in first year, you know, you're not cut out for honours, you need to go drop down to the past class. And parents mostly finding this devastating and trying to challenge schools and trying to get them back into the honours classes. But it's almost like children who are trying to perform at a level outwith their ability, which is really creating the stress. One of the things I think around schools is also the culture is a lot narrower. I just remember my own primary school experience where we would have had mixed ability, but there was a kind of an arm around the shoulder. Oh, that's just that. I work on this book and you work on that book, and we kind of get through it together. And it was a rural school, so one teacher had two classes together, and there was a kind of a forgivingness about that. You know, I heard somebody refer to kind of sometimes schools can become resource-seeking missiles, you know, to get separate classes and separate kids. And I think one of the initiatives from Richard Bruton is to bring in a resource teacher for a whole class as opposed to just one person, which I think is a good initiative to provide the teachers for support, especially with those large numbers. But I think streaming still involves, but I think for us it's something about parents. We need to actually step back and just, you know, support our children's ability at where it's at to be the best that it can be, but not out with that.
You have a 12-year-old who, or 14-year-old who's in second year and has been told, actually, you know what, you should really do pass maths for your junior cert. Parents saying no, and then she's spending all her time trying to get up to that level. And the reality is junior cert means very little unless you're leaving at junior cert level. By the time you get to leaving cert, honours maths is so high, if you're not able for it at junior cert, you're not going to be able for it. So she's now wasted 4 years studying as hard as she can to be told to be due pass.
And unfortunately, that's a familiar story. I think it's another thing that kind of also has creeped into sport. There was an article in The Independent a few weeks ago about lots of them 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds who can't catch, throw, and have lost these kind of manual dexterity skills. And it was put down to tablets and technology as that. But there's also, I think, another issue that sport has become quite competitive and streamed. And lots of young people who I meet who would be destined to the sidelines because, you know, if you're not brilliant, you're useless. And there's sometimes sporting organizations can become kind of Olympian-seeking people. And if you're not at that standard, it can sometimes mean that you're...
And you can see it in even, let's say, just say schoolboy football or school girl football, whatever it is. Four teams, under 14, let's say, A, B, C, and D, and what they do is they take all the best players and put them in A. Now, nobody in B, C, and D has somebody to look up to or somebody to help them or inspire them, and suddenly you've done that. So that is interesting. We're running out of time, of course, so I keep talking, and I do apologise for that. Horror and futility of CIA's torture rooms revealed in files. There's a case going on in the States at the moment. It's quite interesting, where a prisoner died on a black site in Afghanistan. The reason I say this is because sometimes we think when we look at things like Homeland, that it's fiction, that people aren't chained up 24 hours a day, sleep deprived, and playing music at them and tortured and waterboarded. In fact, this is true, and this has come out. The CIA have actually settled this case, so they didn't have to reveal the evidence in court. That was in the Telegraph today. That caught my eye. Also, why marriage problems put a strain on men's heart. We'll talk about that later off air. interesting, a lot of publicity, and in the UK papers as well, about Lance Armstrong tweeted recently, yesterday, I think, that David Walsh essentially was getting the... David Walsh is a journalist who pursued Lance Armstrong and was ultimately found to be right. Lance Armstrong gave him horrendous abuse, eventually turned out to be right. He did apologise, actually, and say that he was right, but David Walsh recently gave a character reference to Tom Humphries, who, of course, was convicted of child sex offences, and he's faced a severe backlash from that as well.
Yeah, that's right. Now, there are two things. Firstly, if David Walsh wrote a character reference for Tom Humphries, currently under the law, anyone who's convicted of anything, whether it's mass murder or whatever, is entitled to people to give character references. And then also there are victim impact statements explaining how devastating what the person did was. So I think if the law says the person is entitled to a character reference, then in a way, it is pretty courageous for somebody to give a character reference to somebody in those circumstances. Now, I don't know the full details of this. I gather David Walsh did more than give a character reference and sort of campaigned in some way on behalf of Tom Humphries, according to the newspapers. I don't know the detail of that. But on the issue of giving a character reference, I don't think we can sort of have some kind of witch hunt against people who give character references for people who are convicted of things, no matter what they were convicted of. They're not arguing that the person... oughtn't to go to jail or didn't do what he was accused of doing. They're simply giving some background to them and giving some explanation, and I think it's probably quite a hard thing for him to do.
Mark, I know you were up at 6:30 this morning to read the papers and take bits out of them as well, so thank you very much for your time. Thanks for coming in. That's Mark Brannock from Murray Consulting, and as I say, a former political correspondent with the Irish Times. We're going to take some music, and we're going to be talking to two adventurers from Carlow in a few minutes.
Television, but how'd we get in? Who gave you eyes like that? Said you could keep them. I don't know how to act or if I should be leaving. I'm running out of time, going out of my mind. I need to tell you something. Yeah, I need to tell you something.
Welcome back. This is Walk In My Shoes Radio, broadcasting live from St. Patrick's Mental Health Services in Dublin 8. Walk In My Shoes Radio is encouraging you to get the conversation started here on Mental Health Week. You can tune into us on 105.2, 106.7, 105.5 and 87.7. It's great that we're here. Welcome Victor and William Clark, who are two solicitors slash adventurers who kindly were on the show last year filling us in on some Arctic marathons that they were taking part in. Victor and William, you're very welcome. Can you tell us a little bit about what's been happening since we saw you last and what's next?
Well, the first thing is you have to get like this, right up
against the mic.
But your lips have to be touching the thing. Go. Otherwise, it sounds like you're in a bubble.
Sorry. Thanks, Coleman. I suppose since last year, I had an interesting thing in that I had a dose of the spins. I think I got a.
I'm lucky you said spins.
I had 365 days of Saturday nights, Coleman. It wasn't vertigo, but I think it was a virus I picked up in Russia the year before. So that put me out of training. You know, if you ever tried training when you've had a few drinks on you, that's what it was like. So we were supposed to do Iceland last year, but we're going to try and do it this year. Now, hopefully in March, April. It had been March, but I've been told recently I'm having a baby in January. So that's put me out by a month anyway.
When you say Iceland, I'm guessing you're not meaning the shopping centre. What does Iceland involve?
We're not quite sure yet. That's why I looked it in.
Yeah, the idea is that we're actually going to traverse across Iceland from south to north. We're going to be cycling, running, kayaking. That's the idea. So it's about a kind of 10-day turnaround to make it from kind of the bottom to the top of it. So
these are seriously enduring tasks, and I believe at some point somebody nearly lost toes through frostbite, etc. Why do you do this? What is it about?
You know, it's funny. Liz, your researcher, asked me that as well. It's hard to know why you do these type of things, but I suppose myself and Will both have small kids, so it's good for kids to be able to see that their sad dad can do something. I suppose they could do it. When you're in a job like ours as well, you're sitting around an awful lot at a desk, and it's good to be able to get out and do something a bit different. My wife says it's because I have three toddlers at home and I'll go to great lengths to get a break.
can I just interrupt, because you did say you were going to go in January, but you can't because that's your fault.
It is. So that's absolutely. Just say,
do you know how that happened?
That's my wife's
You're having
fault.
A baby.
She's the one not letting me go.
There's something just about the actual adventure side of it. There is something about challenging yourself. While the two of us do these things together, it's actually an individual effort as well. So we keep pushing each other as we're going along, but you know, it's a real kind of individual push yourself, because kind of when you're in the North Pole, when you're in Iceland, when you're in all these extreme places, you really have to keep pushing yourself mentally to get to the end of it.
And in terms of when you were growing up, was this part of that, was there a competition between you? Were you kind of high achieving? Where did the signs start that this was going to be something that was going to be part of your life?
Gosh, I wouldn't have thought high achieving.
Our mum is laughing her head off somewhere right now.
I think we were quite competitive, I suppose. Younger, we still are competitive in what we do. But sports-wise, we would have been involved in most things. And we were involved quite a bit with horses, to be honest. And we did that to a very, very high level. So that aspect would have been very competitive when we were younger. We're now kind of moving it into different aspects now. I still do quite a bit of the equestrian stuff, but I suppose this is, I still do quite a bit up to us to go up to the North Pole, to go to Iceland, to go to these places. So we're kind of broadening how we're getting the fix of excitement these days.
And what's it like when you're up there and it's two of you against the elements? And I'm guessing there's times where you just want to think, like, this is too much, or it's time to quit, or enough's enough. What's it like in those moments? How do you draw on each other's spirit or determination in those moments?
Well, it's miserable. But, I mean, I suppose when we're in the office together and I've had enough of him, I can slam his door and walk off in a little hissy fit. But when you're somewhere, you know, like Russia or Iceland or the North Pole, you can't separate from each other. I mean, it's dangerous enough when you're together, let alone separating. But we've been lucky. I mean, we've always got on very well. We've done a lot of training all our lives. Like, William was world under 21 3-day eventing champion back, I won't give away his age, but it wasn't last year, Coleman. And we would have always been involved in high-end sports together. So I suppose, you know, dealing with difficult situations is actually easier when you know the person beside you.
Of course.
You know, because when we were in the North Pole, we met lots of really interesting people, but at the end of the day, they were all strangers. If you want to lean on someone, you have to lean on someone you know.
So let's go back a little bit. What was the first one that you decided to do together? The first one that you extreme one you decided. They all got to be extreme.
Well, the first most extreme one was a 10K.
The most stupid thing we did together. Yeah.
We just started off with 10Ks basically at the very start of it. Very simple. The first real major kind of expedition was the North Pole. You know, and that was.
Seems like a logical progression, 10K the North Pole.
10K in Carlow, in the depths of winter.
Yeah. No, we did one in Enniscorthy, which has a big hill on it, in training Vinegar for hill. The North Pole. Yeah.
I think we overshot the mark quite a bit on that. But in saying that, that's probably the only way to do that. You don't want to sit down and think, I'm going to go to the most remote place in the world and try and do a marathon in minus 50, because you probably just won't do it, you know, so... I think the idea was we just sat down and said, okay, what's interesting? What would we like to do? We picked the North Pole and we just went and did it.
Mm. You come back and then you decide the next one. What was the next one?
Well, the next one actually was Iceland. And we had that lined up ready to go. And then we actually had to pull that kind of mid-training just for, you know, you kind of look and say, oh, well, we're just going, you know, across Iceland. It's not too bad. But to be honest, we did pull it for safety reasons on a basis that we both of us need to be 100% going across that terrain at that time of the year. And there's no point doing this if you're not fully prepared and ready to go in it. And we just thought we'd have to kind of wait until you felt a bit better.
What does the training involve? Like, you're talking 6 months out. Is that probably where you'd start?
Yeah, I was again saying to a researcher, we're only just starting now with about 6-7 months, because if you're doing a training for a marathon, you're training for one day and you can put weight back on the next day, you can get a break, you can rest. But when you've got to go 500 odd kilometers over 10 days, it's marathons every day across mountains, across lakes, across very inhospitable terrain. So I suppose part of the training is as much psychological as it is fitness.
And how do you train psychologically for that? Or how would you prepare yourself for those moments?
You really have to learn how to lie to yourself.
Okay.
You've got to be... You've got to be the greatest deceit in your own life. I mean, you know, the ability... we were saying there, I actually was in Russia in between the North Pole and Iceland, and I was up a mountain, and it was a particularly nasty experience, but...
Like, how high was the mountain?
It was about 19,000 feet. So
it's like Karen Tool.
Yeah. If it had been between Ireland and England, I would have been waving down at Ryanair planes on a flight path. But it was particularly inhospitable, and you need to be able to tell yourself all the time, "Do you know what? I am okay," because you'll scream at yourself a million times a day that it's not worth it, it's not safe, you're going to hurt yourself, you're going to cause distress to your family, you should stop now. Nobody will blame you for losing, and it's that inability to drown out those voices and to be able to say to yourself, no, it is okay, we can do it.
And sometimes, sorry, that's the most attractive part of it. Like, you know, I do remember the North Pole nearly being broken in the middle of it, and being able to come out the other side of that, pushing yourself to come out the other side of that, that, for me anyway, is part of the attraction to it.
So do you seek that gratification when you actually do it, when you endure all that your body and your psychological.
When I crossed the line in the North Pole Marathon, it was one of the craziest experiences I've ever had. That sounds, when people say those things, you kind of think, oh, that's ridiculous. But it was an unbelievable experience just based on the fact of I pushed myself that hard and I could do that. And that for me was great gratification of it. Yeah.
And can I ask you something? Because it's interesting that you're taking on these challenges as you get older. And I'm approaching a big birthday myself in the next couple of weeks. And
50. I've
40, but when you're I went to that Cú Chulainn Taitó Park roller coaster, and 20 years ago I would have sat on it and gone, bring it faster, lifting my hands, whereas now you're thinking, gosh, when was the last time this was serviced, or is that a rattle? And so with age you become more kind of safety conscious and worried about your knees and your joints and these. It's quite the opposite curve for you guys. You're taking on extra challenges as you approach maturity, if that's fair to say. How does that work?
Yeah, well, I don't know about Will, but I think endurance sports aren't about fitness. I mean, the human body could do amazing things if it's pushed. I mean, if you were dropped in the middle of a desert tomorrow and had to walk 300 kilometers to save your life, if you had the supplies, you could do it. It's about, it's a mental thing, endurance. And I think the older you get, the more you can cope with that bit of panic or that bit of adversity, or, you know, when you've had a bit of experience in your life, I suppose it becomes that bit easier.
Yeah.
And is it about belief?
It's about resilience. Mm. I think resilience is being able to, you know, endure what you're enduring, but to be able to find a reason for it. I think you can't endure those type of things unless you have a reason in your head to do it. And it's a good reason, you know. I mean, I'll get back, my family will be proud of me, I'll have done this, I'll be able to remember it. But I think the real thing is, for endurance people like us, it's more of a fear of not doing it than the joy of doing it. It's a fear of failure as opposed to the joy of success.
And that, I read Paul O'Connell's book there over Christmas last year, and that was exactly what he said. He said it's the fear of not succeeding. Like, would you publicise these events that you were going to do before?
Well, I absolutely hate it when he comes up with an idea, because he basically says it and that's it. You know, that's what we're doing, and that's, we release the information on it. And the way, you know, by doing that, we're forcing ourselves to actually comply with what we're saying. And that's, it's probably the best way of doing it. But usually when we come up with an idea, that's going to happen.
So the kind of announcement obligation that once you said it, now we better make this real, plays a role in motivating you to go through it.
Would you say resilience, though, in my personal experience, being forced and overweight, trying to cycle up a mountain.
Yeah, you do a lot of cycling, yeah.
And being unfit. The resilience came from things I've done in the past. And I used to be a DJ, going up the back stairs of a wedding, or down the back stairs at 2 a.m. trying to carry the gear down, tired and not wanting to do it. Yeah. But knowing that if I don't bring that stuff down, it's never going to happen. But when I remember cycling up the mountain, thinking, that's where I'm getting my mental strength from. That was my practice in some ways. It wasn't a sporting thing I had built up. It was actually those moments, or waiting, or standing somewhere, or, you know, standing for 6 hours at a gig somewhere, I'm absolutely bored, but knowing you just have to do it. And I found that those cumulative pieces of resilience actually got me up the side of the mountain and got me down as well, and then back up that next one, because there's always another one. People are texting in and emailing, wondering about Iceland. Tell us, just give us the itinerary for Iceland, where you start, where you will be, where you end, etc.
Well, we're starting in Reykjavik. And we're going up. Now, don't ask me to pronounce names if you've ever seen Iceland.
Spell them,
I'll write them down here, and Shay, you can read them out. But
typical lawyer. Yeah.
But we're going to move. There's quite a big national park towards the centre of Iceland that we undertake the kayaking part of, which is once we can kayak across there, because it's just too big to go around, then we move up onto a mountain.
So kayaking
stage.
First.
It'll be
we're actually going to run. It's running out of. It's just a 10k warm up coming out.
We've been run out of towns before, so we're comfortable starting with that one.
They are running us out of town for about 10k. We cycle then for about 100 or so. We'll then kayak across. Now that actually is the.
Is that before lunch or after lunch?
Yeah, it's the first day. Yeah, it's the first day. So I'm actually quite looking forward to the kayaking.
It's kind of triathlon feel to the first day.
It's something actually reasonable, like the distances are reasonable. It's kind of on day 3-4 where we begin going up mountains and through kind of glaciers and stuff that's going to get very interesting at that stage, because, you know, no matter what kind of research we're putting into this, we really have no idea kind of what we're going to be crossing over.
Yeah, I think there's a good mix between myself and Will, even though we're brothers, we're very different. I mean, Will would be very comfortable cycling a bike or running, whereas I'm 6 years older. My running has seen better days, but I'm much more comfortable on mountains and that type of terrain. So we do have good experience with each other, you know, for different... It's not like we're just both cyclists and we don't know what we're doing when we hit a mountain.
So day one, run out of town, onto the bikes for 100K, kayaking. Day two?
Day two, we're going to be
mountains.
Looking...
Yeah. Day two is the killer day.
Day two is kind of into the mountain range, into the... It's the... park, isn't it? It's like, well, when I say park, it's not like the Phoenix Park. I think it's like
up the slippy steps.
You know, it's the bit of Iceland that tourists won't see. It's the centre of Iceland.
Okay, so you're on the mountains. How many days are you in the mountains for?
I think three and a bit, depending. It's about four, but I'm trying to tailor back a small bit to
see.
And then
when you finish that section?
Then we're actually going to go back onto the bikes again. And I think on the second kind of last day, I think we're on bikes again. We might look at doing a bit of running.
And then
we've got
about 25 kilometers on the last day, which we'll run.
Yeah.
So you're carrying your gear, or have you got a support vehicle, or how does it work?
No, we have a support vehicle coming with us. Now we're
going to be carrying
the gear in the mountains, which I am not happy.
Are there cabins in the mountains?
We'll have tents. And a tent.
Oh, that's okay then.
Well, a tent nowadays.
Again, I am not pleased with that aspect of it either.
Yeah, well, a tent.
What do you mean there's no Marriott there?
We'll have our own tents because I've shared a tent with him before, and I'm happier to carry a tent across a country this
time.
Gas
issue.
But you know, we're not really sure. I mean, a lot of these expeditions, they're adventures for a reason. You don't really know what you're going to do. Weather could stop us riding the bikes, for example. We may have to run. There's large areas of ash up the mountains that's quite deep. So when you're trying to trek across it or run across it, it's like running in sand. It's very difficult. But the reality is you don't know. I mean, when we trained for the North Pole Marathon, we trained in a huge freezer unit in Ace. And we thought it was great training because it was minus 37. But we went up to the North Pole. It was nearly minus 50, but it wasn't the cold. It was the wind. That would get you. Mm. So you just don't know how to train for them.
Just to say as well, you're not just doing it just for yourselves. There's a charitable element to this as well. You're doing it. Walk in My Shoes is one of the...
Yeah, we always keep Walk in My Shoes as our kind of main charity. We always run with us. I actually always think it's a great fit for both. Just on a very simple basis, the Walk in My Shoe name and logo, I think, fits really nicely with trekking the whole way across a country. But as I said earlier, I think it's the kind of mental resilience of it all as well, which is a nice fit.
I mean, I just listened to you here and I think it's absolutely phenomenal. I mean, you mentioned at the start about, you know, showing your kids that you're not a kind of sad dad. Like, in comparison, I put an IKEA shelf together. I make the whole family come in and applaud my work.
So they can be put together.
It has paled in
significance. Can I get your number? What are you doing after this?
I don't make a habit of it. That's why I make such a deal of it. But it's just phenomenal. I mean, I think you're right. The Walk in My Shoes philosophy around resilience, around coping, around trying to dig deep in times of adversity is a wonderful fit with obviously the extreme circumstances of what you do. I think it's phenomenal. Could I bring you to something different? And when you're not tenting in mountains and Arctic minus 50 degrees, you're both solicitors with a specialty with regards to internet law, is that right? Or
William's the internet specialist.
And obviously my own work is in with young people, and so the cyberspace and the difficulties and murky and greyness of that area has it comes up. In terms of the experience of, let's say, for example, sharing images, that sort of stuff. Is that something that you would come across your desk a lot now in terms
Unfortunately, of... Unfortunately, quite a bit. And the last two times we've spoken, Shay, we've spoken a bit about this. And unfortunately, every single year I come in, I say it's getting worse. And every year it is getting worse. And it is unbelievable at the moment how bad it is getting out there on the ground. And the effect that it is having on people is just, you know, and unfortunately... from a very strict legal point of view, there's not much that can be done on it.
We're talking about very intimate images here. We're
talking absolutely.
About
yeah,
pictures
yeah.
that may have been taken by boyfriends, girlfriends, etc. Yeah. Partners, husbands, wives. You know, 20 years ago, if someone was to put a picture of you naked somewhere, it'd be someone taking a secret picture. It's yeah. more likely that you maybe took the picture yourself.
Absolutely.
And somebody yeah. then shared it. I know, Coleman, you kind of had a question around that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we obviously, my experience mirrors yours. It is getting more popular, certainly more regular. But if say, a young person takes an image and shares it with somebody under the arrangement that it's a one-to-one, but that gets shared within a greater connection. And oftentimes, these things will be shared through kind of WhatsApp groups, but there'll be a specific bunch. So there'll be the TY lads in class 4B, or there'll be a particular soccer team under 18s. And these images of their girlfriends will be something that a lot of girls are being kind of... that the information is being shared amongst that group. Do you have... where is the jurisdiction there? Is it school? Is it family? Do the group from which they... voluntarily take part
well,
with?
One of the major issues you're dealing with here is the actual age of the kids. Mm. And usually it is kids. Now, it's not, when I say usually, actually it isn't. But on a basis of TY students and that kind of thing, you're dealing with an age issue where who is going to be culpable for their actions. Again, it also depends on where it occurred. That's a very, very difficult one to prove. Was it on school time, school grounds? If so, the school could be liable for any of the actions. It's a form of bullying. So if it will fall under the school rules, and if they have an anti-bullying policy, which a lot of schools do have at the moment, they don't have great, a lot of schools don't have great cyber policies. So in order to enforce against the school is quite difficult at the best of times in that. Once it's at home, then it's very tricky in that regard as well, because if there was consent for the photo to be taken, that's one issue. Can the person actually consent due to their age is another issue. Sometimes alcohol has been taken, so even if they say, yeah, I agree a picture can be taken, they may not actually be giving their consent because they're unable to give consent.
Bottom line is that nobody has intellectual property over their pictures. No TY student goes and copyrights their images. Mm. So once you give someone an image, it's an image, it's yours.
So the responsibility comes with the share, the ownership. Once you surrender over that digital line, you surrender ownership.
Not to make light of it, but the photo of the monkey that was taken by the monkey itself is a very, very famous case in America last year, where a famous animal photographer left his camera out and a monkey took a selfie with it, and it went all over the world, and the photographer wanted to gain the copyright of the photo because he was there, it was his camera, etc., and he couldn't get it. So he couldn't get the royalties out of the copyright because the monkey actually took the photo itself. So there are so many tricky issues when it comes to the use of photos, who owns them, who can use them, you know. And the biggest problem I have is once it's out of the bottle. You know, there's just no way. There is no way.
But there is, and I remember speaking to you last time as well. You do. There are certain things that you, that they may not be legal remedies. You don't want to pursue it that far. You never really want to go to court with it.
No.
But you've written some strong letters.
Oh, absolutely.
If somebody has a problem, they shouldn't just give up hope.
But isn't it fair to say that a lot of people who do these things don't really realize that they're committing an offence or a crime, or you know, and a letter to a parent or guardian or to them can sometimes make them see, as Will would say, make them see, that was a big mistake, I shouldn't have done that. I didn't realise that it was a criminal offence, because the criminality end of it is where legislation is housed. Unfortunately, there isn't any specific cyberbullying laws, which is difficult. Mm. So to that end, a lot of people that do these things don't really realise, I mean, people who were bullies when they were kids and you meet them nowadays and they're sound, they didn't graduate from being a bully. They just copped on that it wasn't right.
But a good message is that if I know you have
there's
some
always,
stuff. You've stuff online about this
somewhere
as well.
To turn. Yeah, there is always
what's
somewhere.
What's the web address for that? For the practice?
CJ.ie.
CJ.ie.
Yeah.
And that's where you can find some information. But you have written letters for people and stuff has been taken
down.
Oh,
no, absolutely.
Now, I know this could be spread further. Nobody knows how far it's gone.
No, but it's very important for people to know they can always look for help. They should always go to their parents first, or to a teacher, or to a good friend, you know, speak to someone about it. Absolutely. Then I think from there, you know, they can escalate it to the guards. Absolutely. There's no issue about that. A lot of the guards are now very up to speed with how to deal with all these. They'll be discreet. They'll be quiet about it. And of course, solicitors can help. You know, once they work in the area, then definitely they can provide assistance.
Details about your ridiculous Icelandic challenge. When is the, where do we find that? Where do we find it? We want to throw a few bob at you as well.
It's funny. The I'm starting with I have a Twitter account, which I'm going to start doing a bit of.
He calls it the Twitter still.
I am on the www, and you can follow me on that. And I'm going to just do. I'm training with a trainer who trains me for all these things, and we're just going to do a few videos of me getting the crap kicked out of me, basically.
Just if you do put up a video, you shouldn't. Just I have a great solicitor I can recommend. Yeah.
Don't worry, we've copyrighted it within an inch of its life.
What's the 4G coverage like in Iceland? Yeah.
Well, actually,
I bet you it's good.
Really briefly, we were on an island called Longyearbyen, which is up near the North Pole, and it has the fastest Wi-Fi on the planet at 3,000 megs. Experimental Wi-Fi. So you never know where you find these things.
And you were texting.
Yeah. Help.
Victor and William, thanks so much for coming in. Really appreciate it. Great to see you. But anyway, once more, cj.ie for the legal advice, and then just put in Iceland challenge mad Jumflis from Garlo if you want any more details. That's the end of our show today. Coleman?
Yeah, lovely to get a chance to spend some time with you there, Shay, over the morning, and very thanks to all our guests, Roisin Dolan, Victor and William Clark, and Mark Brennick
and Jim Breen as well.
Fabulous day.
And listen, I have to say, you're a natural radio person. You could be here tomorrow if I'm sick.
There you go.
I feel a temperature.
You could be interviewing us next year, Colin.
You probably will. That's it from this show. We're back again tomorrow, 9 to 11. Laura Woods and Dustin the Turkey are coming up next. Thanks so much for joining us in Walk in My Shoes Radio.
Past my hidden treasure chest, golden grand piano, my beauty focus EOU. Ooh, you, ooh, I'd leave it all. My acres of a land I've achieved. It may be hard for you to stop and believe, but for you,